The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 3 of this 5-day session here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in July 2017. And I'd like to share with you something of the life and teachings of one of the two men who's considered to be founders of the Soto sect. Soto and Rinzai, back then, during the golden age of Zen, they weren't so different. They later diverged in terms of teaching methods and also administrative structures as well. And now they're quite different in some areas. But in America, there have been at least 3 Zen teachers of the original group of Zen teachers in America who had trained in both Rinzai and Soto, one way or the other. And in the case of Aiken Roshi, Robert Aiken, and the case of Philip Kaplow, they both trained under Yasutani Roshi, and he was a Dharma heir of a man who was actually a Soto priest, Soto monk, who was not really, he was discouraged by the level of training. And that means the level of deep, intensive awakening potential that the Soto school had back then. And he spent quite a few years training in Rinzai Monastery. And so as a result, even though the Soto school has not taught koans in the traditional way for more than a century at this point, they were able to do that because they trained under someone who had trained within the Soto and the Rinzai schools. So although they were nominally Soto, they had also access to authentic Rinzai training. Soto came to America as well as what we'd call perhaps a Pure Line in the San Francisco Zen Center and in the different centers that it spawned. Katagiri Roshi originally came for the San Francisco Zen Center, but ended up in Minnesota. And there are many generations now of purely Soto teachers in America. There are a number of generations at this point as well, though not so many, of what I guess I would call an amalgam of Rinzai and Soto Zen. And then there's very little actual pure Rinzai in America. And I think actually you can count them on fewer fingers than a full hand. But way back in the 800s, they were much more dynamic, much more alike. The Zen school divided into or subdivided into what they called the five houses of Zen. The two remaining ones are Rinzai and Soto. There were others as well, 3 others as well, but they more or less faded out or were absorbed into particularly Chinese Zen. And they developed as a result of the personalities and teaching methods of the teachers involved. Nonetheless, at the time they developed, there weren't such vast differences as there are now. And I'd like to, again, share with you some of the life and teachings of one of the two men who founded what is now known as the Soto School. His one is named Tungshang Liangzhi, and you will be familiar with that name if you've chanted the ancestral line. We have two ancestral lines we chant here at Hidden Valley Zen Center. One is the Rinzai line through Sogenji. The other is the Rinzai Soto Amalgam line through Kapla Roshi and the Rochester Zen Center. And it's in that Rochester Zen Center lineage chant. These lineage chants, by the way, the Te Dai Denpo is the Rinzai one, and the ancestral line is the Soto one, or the Soto Amalgam one. These are the names of the people for whom these lineages were handed down in direct line to today. There, of course, were other Rinzai masters, men and women both, and the same with Soto. But in terms of the lineage, it's sort of like your family tree. You and your mother or father and their parents, except you just go up one line. Say you take your mother's side. Your mother, your grandmother, her mother, your great-grandmother, her grandmother, her mother, and so on and so forth, all the way up to the Buddha. And that is what these lineages are about. And we recite them out of respect and honor and as inspiration to ourselves. These are the people who worked so hard, some of them in ancient times, in order to pass the training, the teaching, the Dharma on to us here centuries later. We owe them really a debt of gratitude, which is why we put our hands in gassho when we do those two chants. So, on to Tungshang Liangzhi, whose name in Japanese is pronounced Dongshan. And he was born in 807. He didn't live that long. He only lived to be 62 years old. Died in 869. Actually, well, anyway, my math is a little rusty. And he was born in eastern China. And in those days, the center of Zen was in the west. And so he traveled west. But as a child, he was considered to be rather unusual. He must have come from a fairly wealthy family because he had a tutor. And one day, he and the tutor are going over the Heart of Perfect Wisdom chant that we chant every day. And he came to the words, "No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind." And he sort of felt his face, his nose, ears, eyes. He said, "Why does it say that there are no eyes, ear, nose, tongue? But clearly I have them." At which point his tutor said, "I'm not sufficient to teach you." And he was sent off to a monastery to become a monk. It doesn't say at what age he was, but probably, could have been anywhere under 10 or 12 years old. And from then on, he trained in the Dharma. When he was 21, he took the full precepts. But before that, as a child, his head was shaved and he was in robes and in training. And he worked with a teacher until that teacher died. He was only 35 years old when that teacher died. And so then he sought out another teacher. The traditional way of training back then in China was to spend a certain amount of time with a teacher, have an awakening experience, And then travel around and test the depth of your awakening in the halls of other teachers. But he soon settled on a second teacher, and then finally a third teacher. And somewhere in the line, he had two major Kensho experiences. And eventually, when he was teaching, I'd like to share an encounter that he had with one of his monks. He had, somewhere in the sutras it says, even the grasses and trees expound the Dharma. And so he had another question: how can inanimate things expound the Dharma? How can a tree talk? How can a tree tell you the truth of the universe? Well, it can. And eventually he learned to comprehend that, and we can as well. It's a very important teaching, actually. We assume that in order to learn anything, we have to read a book, we have to hear a lecture, we have to watch a recording, a video recording. There has to be some way of hearing it with our ears and or reading it in a book, reading it with our eyes, or being told what it is. We go to school and we learn in that way. But there's a deeper level of understanding that we're all capable of. Although, if we've been severely traumatized, it's in part shut down. And that is a comprehension beyond words, beyond sight. A tuning in to something ineffable. It's interesting that when we take our women veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress on a walk through the forest that we have a boundary with at Mountain Gate in our Regaining Balance retreats for women veterans with PTSD, it's amazing the responses they have. And if you go out into the woods, particularly where it's not highly traveled, and allow yourself to be and allow yourself to tune in, there's a vast amount of communication going on. The trees are teaching the Dharma. The wind is teaching the Dharma. The warm sun on our face is teaching the Dharma. But because we are trained, and our society demands really that we live in this other, more mental world, we don't always live out of that place. But Dongshang Liangzhi was puzzled. How can the earth teach the Dharma? It's not sentient, supposedly. Sentient means having thoughts, having minds. How can the trees and grasses teach the Dharma? This comes out of some ancient teachings of the Buddha, and there's still controversy about it, whether these things can teach the Dharma. But if you're aware and sensitive, you know they can. So let's get into this event here. After visiting Nanchuan, the master, who is Tungshan Liangzhi, made a visit to Kuaishan and said to him, "I have recently heard that the national teacher Chung of Nanyang maintains the doctrine that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma. I've not yet comprehended the subtleties of this teaching." Kuaishan said, "Can you, Acharya, remember the details of what you heard?" "Yes, I can," said the master. "And why don't you try to repeat it for me?" said Kuaishan. The master began. "A monk asked Kui Chung, 'What sort of thing is the mind of the ancient Buddhas?' The national teacher replied, 'It's wall and tile rubble.'" "Wall and tile rubble? Isn't that something non-sentient?" asked the monk. "It is," replied the national teacher. The monk said, "And yet it can expound the Dharma?" By the way, this is Dharma with a capital D, which means the teachings, it represents the teachings of the Buddha, but it's the teaching of reality. "It is constantly expounding it, radiantly expounding it without ceasing," replied the national teacher. The monk asked, "Then why haven't I heard it?" The national teacher said, "You yourself haven't heard it, but this can't hinder those who are able to hear it." "What sort of person acquires such hearing?" asked the monk. "All the sages have acquired such hearing," replied the national teacher. The monk asked, "Can you hear it, Hoshang?" Hoshang is a polite term for master teacher. "No, I can't," replied the national teacher. And if he's a national teacher, he's incredibly highly regarded. He's clearly been shown to be outstanding in his understanding of the Dharma, in his comprehension, which means he's had some deep awakening experiences. Which makes you wonder, how come he can't? The monk said, if you haven't heard it, how do you know that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma?" The national teacher said, "Fortunately, I haven't heard it. If I had, I would be the same as the sages, and you, therefore, would not hear the Dharma that I teach. In that case, ordinary people would have no part in it," said the monk. "I teach for ordinary people, not sages," replied the national teacher. "What happens after ordinary people hear you?" asked the monk. "Then they're no longer ordinary people," said the national teacher. The monk asked, "According to which sutra does it say that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma?" "Clearly, you shouldn't suggest that it's not part of the sutras. Haven't you seen it in the Avatamsaka Sutra? It says, 'The earth expounds Dharma, living beings expound it. Through the three times, everything expounds it.'" The master thus completed his narrative. Kuaishan said, "That teaching also exists here. However, one seldom encounters someone capable of understanding it." Tungshan said, "I still don't understand it clearly. Would the master please comment?" Kuaishan raised his fly whisk, saying, "Do you understand?" A fly whisk is it's a horsehair whisk that's used to, chase away the flies around the master's body. And it's also a symbol of transmission. So Kuaishan raised his fly whisk, saying, "Do you understand?" "No, I don't understand. Please, Hoshang, explain," replied Tungshan. Kuaishan said, "It can never be explained to you by means of the mouth of one born by mother or father." Tungshan asked, "Does the master have any contemporaries in the way who might clarify this problem for me?" "From here, go to Yuxian of Liling, where you'll find some linked caves. Living in those caves is a man of the way, Yunyan. If you're able to push aside the grass and graze into the wind, then you will find him worthy of your respect," said Kuaishan. And there's a note on this, "push aside the grass." Actually, it's more about Yunyan was living in a series of, they're more like little alcoves cut out of the mountain. And apparently, to this day, there are monks still living in there. "Then you will find him worthy of your respect," said Kuaishan. "Just what sort of man is he?" asked Dongshan. Kuaishan replied, "Once," he said to this old monk, "what should I do if I wish to follow the master?" This old monk, who really was Kuaishan, replied, "You must immediately cut off your defilements." He said, "Then will I come up to the master's expectation?" And this old monk replied, "You will get absolutely no answer as long as I am here." So Tungshan accordingly took leave of Kuaishan and proceeded directly to Yunyan's. Making reference to his previous encounter with Kuaishan, he immediately asked what sort of person was able to hear the Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings. Yunyan said, non-sentient beings are able to hear it. "Can you hear it, Hoshan?" asked Tungshan. Yunyan replied, "If I could hear it, then you would not be able to hear the Dharma that I teach." "Why can't I hear it?" asked Tungshan. Yunyan raised his fly whisk and said, "Can you hear it yet?" Tungshan replied, "No, I can't." Yunyan said, "You can't even hear it when I expound the Dharma. How do you expect to when non-sentient being expounds the Dharma?" Tungshan asked, "In which sutra is it taught that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma?" Yunyan replied, "Haven't you seen it? In the Amitabha Sutra it says, water, birds, tree groves, all without exception, recite the Buddha's name, recite the Dharma." Reflecting on this, Tungshan composed the following gatha. How amazing, how amazing. Hard to comprehend that non-sentient beings expound the Dharma. It simply cannot be heard with the ear, but when sound is heard with the eye, then it is understood. And here's something very relevant, even more so to our practice. Tungshan said to Yunyan, "I have some habits that are not yet eradicated." And you recall that we've been talking a great deal about the long maturation, which is where we take what we begin to open to in our practice into our daily life and work on letting go our unskillful habit patterns. This is something that naturally can take place through practice, because as we go deeper and deeper into our meditation, particularly through the use of the extended out-breath, but also with the questioning of the koan, which would ordinarily, the way it's taught here, take place simultaneously, we begin to gain insights into how we've behaved. And if we take those and take them to heart, allow ourselves to not push them aside, but to walk into the full remorse and regret we have at behaving that way, then it goes a long way to weakening that habit pattern. And it's so much easier not to engage in it next. It's important to do that. This is part of what he's speaking to. And Yunyan said, "What have you been doing?" Tungshan replied, "I've not concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths." Yunyan said, "Are you joyful yet?" In other words, have you had some level of awakening? I'm sure that Yunyan would have been able to perceive that. So I'm not sure why he's asking about the joy. Tungshan said, "It would be untrue to say that I'm not joyful. It is as though I have grasped a bright pearl in a pile of shit." When we have an awakening experience, we get a glimpse into the truth of reality, into the fact that this self-image is nothing but an invention, a caricature. It has no reality. That the true reality is very different. And when we realize that we're free, at least momentarily, of that tyranny, of that self-image, that we can see clearly, at least for a little while, then it is a tremendous source of joy and a feeling of incredible freedom. But it's still a bright pearl in a pile of shit. We still have our habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion that we then are better able to work at letting go, cleaning up that pile of shit, living more and more and more in a way that represents our true nature, that expresses our true nature without hindrance, without being filtered by that self-image. And this is a very important aspect of Zen practice. In the old days, in Zen, and still in some places in America yet, the emphasis is on coming to awakening. And nothing is said after that. The big deal is to have a Kensho. And it's not even specified that that's only the beginning, and that one is urged to continue practicing and open more and more and more and more to deeper and broader understanding, to let go more and more, to see more clearly and deeply through this tenacious, tyrannical self-image, and to little by little become more and more free to express naturally the compassion and wisdom that is innate in us. You've heard before that the great Zen master Hakuin had 19 major Kensho experiences and countless smaller insights. That's a wonderful model for us to keep on going, to keep on going, to reach deeper, not to be satisfied, and to be willing to face our crap and to work to let it go, let it drop away. Inanimate things can expound the Dharma. As we become more and more aware and sensitive through our Zazen, we begin to tune in and can experience that. But it truly is that we cannot hear voices, yet we understand. And we can be inspired. So to do the practice in the faith that if you persist, it will come to fruition and your life will be increasingly filled with peace, joy, and equanimity, no matter what the outward circumstances. That you'll be able to be brave and more sincere and more clear and more let go in your interactions. And I don't think anybody would want to go back to where we were at the beginning. It's hard work. It takes, as Hakuin said, straightforward bravery to be willing to see where we're caught instead of turning our backs on it and shoving it into the back of a drawer or the closet or under the rug. But if we do the practice correctly, which means continuing to search, especially through that extended out-breath, and to search wordlessly, because words will not reach, they cannot reach where we're trying to open to, then it will happen. You can have faith that it will. And I think that's enough for today. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.